For 1 week and 1 week only, men are invited onto Radio Gorgeous. Welcome to Man Week.
I'm John Wire. I'm a garden designer based just outside London, and I've been doing this for quite a few years.
When I first met you, I heard you say gun designer, which was a little off-putting, but then I understood garden designer. What got you interested in garden design, and how, you know, how was that? Were you young? How was that sparked in you?
That's an interesting question, actually. It was the most unusual of things in the sense that it was actually a school careers officer, and I must be about the only person in the world who was put onto this by a school careers officer as a landscape architect. So I trained as a landscape architect, and I then went into garden design. Garden design is something that mostly people come into quite late in life. They switch careers, many of them. A lot of people come into it in their 40s, 50s. And I was an external examiner at a college until a couple of years ago, and we had one student who was in his 70s. But typically people don't go into it straight away, which is a pity because it's a great career. I caught the plant bug after the design bug. So I first became interested in design. I wanted to be an architect, and my father told me that I needed maths for an architect, which is rubbish. And so I switched to landscape architecture, and then I got really, really interested in plants. In the year between leaving school and going to university, I worked in a nursery, and I just became completely hooked on plants.
Is it the variety of plants? Is it what thrills you about plants?
You know what boys are like. They like collecting. They like lining things up. My son has books of the same series, and he lines them up on a shelf, never reads them. You know, he just likes lining them all up. And I'm like that with plants, you know. So they have Latin names, which we just do to make it difficult for everyone else. And
it's like a fetish.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a secret society. Yes. That's what it is. It's a secret society.
You're like plant magician.
Yeah, exactly. If you knew all the secrets, you know, that it's would like, be it. The mystery would be gone. So I do like to know all the different names, the Latin names of all the plants, and I like to line them up on my mental shelf and say, oh, yes, that one and that one and that one and that one. And actually, when you get a load of garden designers together, the first thing they do is all start talking Latin names to each other. Oh, do you know such and such? Oh, yes, do you know such and such? And the really funny thing is that you get these Latin names followed by a variety name, and the variety name is normally something which is quite memorable. So you'll get a Latin name followed by something like pink bloomers or something like that, you know, which is
you're just having fun. It's yeah. Good for you guys.
Yeah. That's right. Okay. Yeah, because that's going to be something that you remember. If it was just called something like Red Beauty, you wouldn't remember it. So they do sometimes have the most ridiculous names, which coupled with the Latin names just adds a sort of slight air of ridiculousness to it, you know.
And fun.
Yeah, great fun. Okay. Yeah.
And so you're going to initiate me into some of the delights of garden, because as okay. I have told you, I have the black thumb of death.
Okay.
I'm not a green thumb. Although, as I get older, I am more interested in having a garden, but one that's easy to maintain, etc. Like, and I like results. I'm a results person. So vegetables have always been, you know, that's always been where I, you know, I love tomatoes and, you know, that kind of gardening.
You say tomatoes.
Potato. Okay. So let's talk, because, you know, we're in London. Most of your work is in London. Everyone, you know, has more or less the same house. And there's a front garden and a back garden. Talk to me about front gardens.
Front gardens are unusual in the sense that they are only designed to be looked at. But, of course, there are two sides to that, because it's not only what they look like as you walk up the path or as you look out of your front window, but they're designed to be looked at by everybody else as well. Everybody who walks past who either knows your house or doesn't know your house. So it's a sort of mantelpiece, if you like, of your house outside. And you're displaying your good taste to everybody else. And that's part of what front gardens are like, whether we like to admit it or not. And so this is just a note to all those people out there with really scruffy front gardens. You know?
this is what you're putting out there.
Yeah, that's you're right. That's right. Your shirt's untucked, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. This is what we think you look like in yeah. I like to have that dichotomy.
Yeah. Of course, that could be a deliberate statement. Yes. You know, you could be saying, yeah. But of course, my back garden is just wonderful, you know. I don't like to show that, though. That would be ostentatious.
Exactly. That would be inviting envy.
Yes. Quite.
Okay,
and we just don't
theory.
Do that.
I'm going to go with that theory on my yeah. garden. But yeah, and also, a lot of people pave over the gardens because, like you say, it's as it is more or less for show, people like it tidy.
Yeah.
And tidy means pave it over, which means, to my mind, more flooding, you know, no water going through to the water table, and then more flooding in our streets.
That's right. And especially for big front gardens where there's a lot of car parking, that's especially true. And the way around that is that you can't park in the last little bit up to the wall. So, I mean, firstly, you can have permeable paving, which basically just means the water goes through the cracks. Or you can have the paving just gently falling off either side into a planting bed. And then all the water that falls on it will just go into the planting bed and water the plants. And then you don't have to water the plants. And the roots of the plants will get underneath and they'll gently pick up any water that comes through the paving. And the fences or walls on either side will be lovely and green. So it's easily done.
So we're just being lazy.
Yes. Yes.
And it's really not, and therefore, I see, I like the language you're talking. It takes care of itself. So it doesn't require me.
That's right.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like a self-maintained garden.
Welcome to Man Week on Radio Gorgeous.
We started talking a little bit about biodiversity.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're worried about we're losing plant species, we're losing animal species. What can the front garden do?
Well, front gardens can do quite a lot. Back gardens can do a lot more. But biodiversity, it just means lots of species, lots of stuff. And so the moment you start putting plants in, each plant will support lots of other species, lots of other insects, and those insects will support lots of other birds and so forth. Now, there is, you know, I actually like to see smaller front gardens completely planted and have a mix of plants that just support themselves. And you'd maybe have to do some pruning now and again, but that's about it. And people will just stop and look and say, and your garden becomes a landmark on the street.
It's true. I do walk by. There's some people have some lovely roses, and I always sniff them and see if, you know, people have nice things, or especially, you know, if there's wisteria, or, you know, it's a public service in that
it,
way.
It is. And the whichever way your front garden faces, you know, roses are good in a south-facing front garden or wisteria, but in a north-facing front garden, you can grow hydrangeas, or, you know, if you want something smaller, peonies and things like that. There's always things that you can put in, and you can have an extended flowering season. By having, you know, some climbers and some shrubs and some bulbs, and it's possible to get things just ticking over all the time, and I think it's a bit like, you know, when you have a small space like that, it's difficult for me because I have a long list of plants that I want to put in, and it's a bit like, you know, trying to invite everybody to your birthday party but actually only having 5 seats or something like that, you know. But you can just whittle it down and get plants that will perform properly at different times of year. You just need to look at the flowering times, and actually the flowering times are almost more important than the flowering colours, because most of the time two things aren't in flower at the same time. Okay. So
you can have an all yellow garden because it just happens different times of the year.
Yeah.
If that's what you like.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were talking also about, because a lot of people's front gardens and frequently back gardens are quite dark, small spaces and in the city. Talk to me a little bit about what you consider when you look at a small space like that.
I think perhaps the most important thing is that small spaces are about design. But when you talk about design, most people immediately start thinking of a plan. And really, with small spaces, it's the totality of the space that's important. So you're talking about three dimensions, and particularly about the vertical planes and how the planes meet. So if you look out of a window in a small garden, into a small garden, what you'll tend to see is the fences or the neighbouring buildings and things like that, rather than what's on the floor. So actually treating that space in three dimensions, like a stage set, if you like, looking at the scenery that is around, is more important than actually getting the plan right. Although the plan is very important, but those vertical spaces are very important, particularly in light wells, basement light wells, things like that, which are an increasing feature in London gardens. Those vertical spaces are very important, and also using things that you have to have in a sculptural way, so that, for example, making a feature of a staircase, mm-hmm. so that the staircase itself becomes part of the sculptural nature mm-hmm. of the space. So we've done staircases that are sort of cantilevered off a wall, and they become something in themselves, or sometimes they look quite dramatic in the way that they work, and you can have alcoves underneath them where you can put water features, and you know, you can play around a lot, because they are, you know, the way staircases work, quite sculptural. And also, instead of having a single rise of a story of a retaining wall for a basement light well, we often break it halfway and put some planting in, just to have a bed that breaks that, so that when you're looking out, you can clothe almost the whole wall in planting if you want to, with climbers. And that works very well.
Radio Gorgeous.
In deeper light wells, we often use living walls, which are, they're basically, if you put a climber in and persuade it to grow up a wall, what it wants to do, like all of us, is get to the sun. So it will tend to concentrate all its leaves at the top of the wall, where it gets the most energy, and won't bother to have anything down the bottom. So you get a sort of slightly untidy looking bit at the bottom. If you the way a living wall works is that you basically have loads and loads of small plants in a matrix, which is in basically a plastic frame or something like that. You can even do them with gutters. But so you might have several hundred or several thousand plants, individual plants, and each of those is of course constricted to its own place, so it has to grow there. So it just adapts to that situation, and you use lower light tolerant species at the bottom, and those can be great. These can be really good. In dark spaces, you are limited to ferns and ivy and things like that. But as you get towards the top of the wall, you can get more flowering plants in. And if it's, even in a basement light well, if it's south-facing, often you can get quite a lot of different coloured foliage and flowers in. So they can be really exciting as well. But we also use water features quite a lot, simple water walls. We use timber strips and trellis. We use stone strips. We use mirrors. We use, we've recently started using quite a lot of different acid etched and patinated metals. And core 10 steel, acid etched copper, things like that. And we use combinations of materials as well, and mosaics, so that you get quite a interesting textures and feel to it that really adds something to that space, and really,
it,
you
makes
know,
it makes it a unique
space
and very different, because it's not just the plants in the garden.
No.
And also, but plants, living plants, there is a lushness to a space, especially a small space. It just adds. It smells different. It feels different.
I think it goes much, much deeper than that. I think it goes much deeper than that. If you look at almost every culture, that paradise, or the concept of paradise, is a garden.
True.
And that we have quite a sub-rational relationship with plants. And this is why horticultural therapy works so well, and why, you know, I have been gardening now for at least 40 years, and every year I sow beans and tomatoes and things like that, and you would think I was a six-year-old kid when the seeds come up, and I know I could tell you to the day when they're going to come up, but that doesn't stop me going out every day. Are they there? Pulling back a little bit of salt. Look, and then I get so excited. Why is that? I've been doing it for 40 years. Why do I still have the excitement of a six-year-old when a bean produces two leaves? You know, it's there's nothing rational about that. But
that, it is miraculous.
It is miraculous. It
and
is
that,
miraculous.
That the whole potential of those leaves and to make more beans is in that bean.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's fantastic.
That is crazy talk.
It's fantastic. And so one of the fantastic things about garden design is that you are working with both things. You're working with this idea, this this relationship that people have with plants, which is really quite a complicated and unusual one. I mean, we do have similar relationships with other things, music, food, you know, that are sort of sub-rational relationships. But with plants, it's slightly different. But the other thing is that you're, in terms of design, you're working with something that changes. It changes, you know, it moves with the weather, with the wind, the flowers. You get flowers that open up in the morning and close again at night. And you know, your garden changes daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, you know, and you can never completely... I always think as a garden designer, we're not... You know, it's a mistake to talk. First of all, it's a mistake to talk about maintenance, because maintenance implies that that's it. It's finished.
Right.
That's it. All you have to do is sweep it and clip it and it will stay the same forever. And of course, that's nothing could be further from the truth. But that actually what we do is we launch ships and other people sail them off to wherever they're going. And I think there's a very poetic idea here, which is that you can't have a garden without a gardener. It doesn't exist. The two things are completely interrelated. So to have a garden, you have to have a space that has boundaries. That's the first thing. And you have to have a gardener. And you can't have a garden without a gardener, because it just becomes a landscape. And so that idea of that sort of interrelationship goes to the heart of what gardens are and what our relationship with gardens is. And that's why I still find it exciting after all these years to be involved in it.
All right, well, let's go out into an actual garden.
Okay.
Let's see if we can launch a ship.
Darling, I only listen to Radio Gorgeous. Aha!
Well, we have walked out into my back garden on a blustery poo-like day. And we really haven't done anything here since we moved in a couple of years ago, except move my mother-in-law's peony, which doesn't look like it's doing that well. You might give me some tips on that.
Well,
while it is alive.
it's alive. It's at that time of year where it's just climbing out of the covers and taking a rest. So I wouldn't worry too much about
it. Good.
So
okay.
That's fine.
But yeah, so it's a sort of bog standard London back garden that has been paved, and it has two side beds. What it does have is a big fig tree.
Mm-hmm.
And since you're so very nice, I will give you some of my berry mead fig chutney. Because as a gardener who grows things, it doesn't matter if they're not the best figs. Of course they're the best figs because they grew them.
Yes, exactly. No. That's what my description on Twitter says. I love to grow things and cook with them, especially, you know, when the two go together. So absolutely. Yeah.
My husband wants a lawn. Are lawns worth the trouble?
Depends how many acres you have.
Not so many.
I think in small London gardens, lawns, it's not that they're not worth the trouble. They are trouble. And the reasons for that are that firstly, they get very compacted, and the pollution doesn't help. So you tend to get very poor drainage, and all the use, if you had a big lawn, there are parts of it you probably never walk on, and the use of it is spread over quite a big area. The smaller the lawn is, the more concentrated the use is on it. So it gets worn out, it gets compacted, it doesn't drain well, it's often shady because the boundaries are much closer. So you put all those things together, it's not good. And it ends up being muddy and unusable for quite a lot of the year. Am I?
You're not,
you know,
selling it.
Am I not selling it? No.
Which is it? Fine, Barbie. Okay. So, but in the absence of that, because I have these big ugly concrete paving stones, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, how do I green it up without?
Okay.
Having
well,
a lawn?
Well, the, I think the first thing that. there's several things here, but the first thing is that the proportion of paving to planting is not in the right ratio, let's say.
I would agree with you there.
So you need to have more planting and less paving here, because you've probably got something like 85-90% of the garden is paved, and you can't use most of it, so you end up standing things on it and standing pots on it, and you know, so all of that could actually be planted, the bits that you're not using, and you're not using quite a lot of it, so it doesn't really need to be paved. And also those paved areas that are surrounded by planting become little enclaves that are just wonderful to use. Mm-hmm. Then so that actually makes the bits that you are using that much more valuable, that much feel, that much nicer. The other thing is that the shapes that you've got here are very square. They're very, yes, what we call orthographic, so everything is running at 90 degrees to each other, and it follows the boundaries. And all that actually does is emphasize where the boundaries are.
Yes.
And the boundaries also have got very little growing on them. You've got very little in the way of climbers. There is, you know, there's quite a nice clematis growing at the end there. Mm-hmm. And you've got a little bit of jasmine over here, but not much. Mm-hmm. And you can see a lot of brown fence and brickwork. And so I would actually get things growing on the boundaries. And then I would try and have some shapes in the center here that actually work to their own geometry, so that the garden has its own geometry and that is separate from the boundaries. It doesn't, yes, try and draw your attention to the boundaries. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that can be putting things at angles, or sometimes it's putting another shape in completely, like a circle or an oval or part of a shape. And working with, so, you know, the fig tree is quite nice, and it hides that really beautiful building behind. So I would keep that, possibly prune it up a bit, have some planting around it, and start working with the shapes. You know, it works quite well that you've got to get over to that corner in the left-hand corner at the back there. The fig tree's on the right, so that you start to have a space, a sense of another axis there that you can get through. And I would do away with the wall that's here and have you know, steps that run most of the width of the garden, so you feel you're not constricted to going up just a little space in the middle, it's, yes, a little bit tight, and just to actually have something a bit broader, so that it's your garden, you feel you can walk wherever you want up there instead of having to go where dictated to, right in the middle. And
those are some, just immediately, some incredibly good suggestions that are also achievable.
Yeah, and not expensive.
Nice. Yeah.
Welcome to Man Week on Radio Gorgeous.
Okay, so we've talked about de-emphasizing the borders by making sort of your garden grow up your walls.
I think this garden is big enough to have a this space and a that space. Mm-hmm. So it's not big. I mean, we're looking at what, perhaps 6-7 meters to, mm-hmm, the end, and probably 4-5 meters wide, something like that. So it's from where we're standing, and then there's a little bit that goes up the side of the house behind us. But it's not a big garden, but there is enough space here to have, you know, a little dining space and a little lounging space, or a bench or something, mm-hmm, like that somewhere. And actually, one of the really interesting things about that in gardens is that you can, that there's, gardens are very romantic places, and often you build you build things in, or places in, that you're actually not going to use in the way that they're designed, but they just look like that. Mm-hmm. So most people don't go and sit on garden benches most of the time because they're a bit wet and uncomfortable, and, you know, and it's, you know.
I do have coffee there in summer mornings.
Okay, well, there you go.
I do, so, and it's fun to sit and look back at the,
yeah,
house, which is,
yeah,
a,
yeah,
perspective you don't get.
No, that's true.
I would say in your,
but if you had a really nice chair there and some, mm-hmm, plants around it, and,
yes,
it would look,
it
like somewhere
lovely,
that you would really want to go and sit and have coffee, you know. Yeah. And then you could come, yeah, back, and you could sit and look at the house and think, actually, I need to sort that bit out as well,
yes,
and do that bit over there. And so, yeah.
And so is the idea, because for me in, you know, in classic garden design, you go to places like Chiswick House, and there's always at the end of, you know, they have like a goose foot
path,
yeah, and at the end of each,
is it the end of a vista.
Vista,
yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Well, even in small gardens, that works quite well,
yeah,
and it's possible to have a you can have a full stop at the end of something, and I think you have to be careful that it's not too obvious. And you know, what's quite nice here is that already the door in the building at the end is off to one side, mm-hmm, so you've already got an axis set up that is diagonal, which you could build on. If that went straight down from here to there, and, you know, then that would be a little
quite
bit more
boring.
Obvious, quite,
yeah,
boring, you know.
Yeah.
So you can start to build on that, and that sort of geometry and those sort of axes are really important. And there should be elements of surprise, unexpectedness in gardens, and just when you think you know what's going on, there should be another little surprise around the corner. And even in small gardens, that's quite, mm-hmm, achievable.
And when you say that, what do you mean by that?
Well, it can be so that you couldn't see everything immediately when you looked out, or it can be that there's something hidden just around the corner behind that tree, or that when you go down there and you look back, suddenly you look at the house and there's something unexpected, you know.
That you there. Can only see you from can, that
yeah, perspective. Exactly so.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Keeping yourself visually entertained all the time.
Yeah.
It's not the same. What's your favorite garden?
Apart from my garden, what's my favourite garden? Gosh, there are so many.
Do you find it difficult to move house?
I think actually, I think my favourite garden, and this is it may at first seem a bit of a boring answer, but is the Alhambra and the Generalife in Granada, and the reason for that is. I think it's fascinating because it's really big, but it's just a collection of quite small spaces that go from one to another to another to another, and the geometry is fascinating because it's never quite what you expect. It's never quite square, and it goes just kinks a little, and there are always things going off at one angle or another, and every so often you get the most amazing views out over the surrounding countryside to remind you that you are in fact on the top of a big lump of rock on the top of a hill, and that, you know, it was there as a summer retreat for the family, and so although it's very big, it has a really intimate feel to it, but also intellectually I'm quite interested in it because it holds a unique position in garden design history, because it really was a sort of spring point for a lot of European garden design, and it represents a turning point that marriage between Islamic garden design and European gardens. Medieval gardens before that had been really about growing fruit and vegetables, and they were just beginning to move in the direction of raised beds being something other than for growing things in, and that garden really sort of was the pinnacle of that thinking of that time that really launched all the Renaissance gardens after that, was sort of in many ways referential back to that, and I don't think it's that position has really been explored enough, because the architecture of that time didn't turn out to be nearly as influential. The you know, Renaissance architecture harked back to Roman gardens and so forth. But a lot of garden design was actually much more derivative of Islamic garden design. And in fact, the English Edwardian garden movements of Jekyll and Lutyens and you know, those sort of Vita Sack, Will West, those really refer back to Islamic garden design a lot. So it's really interesting.
And it to me, that brings to mind the gardens of Alhambra, is that these... It is just like interior design, making these bespoke, jeweled spaces, and very considered.
Yes, yes.
And that very not exact geometry makes you look at them. It makes you pay attention. Whereas if it's uniform, you know, I mean, you think of the Gardens of Versailles, it's just a you know, almost like looking at the ocean.
Well, the Gardens of Versailles were just a display of power. One didn't really get the impression
it's
that
scale.
They were to be scale. It's
Ecarium
look
scale.
At my wad, you know, it's exactly. Shake the money. And whereas the Alhambra, you really felt like it was for the use of the family.
Yes,
and
personal.
It was personal. It really was. And so it goes right to the heart of what gardens are really about. And they're not really about the display of wealth and power, although they can be. But it's about how you feel about it and how your relationship with the space and how you're going to be using it. And they are very beautiful and they do change a lot. But even now, you know, hundreds of years later, those gardens still feel quite personal when you walk around them with the 92,000 other people you're walking around with, of course. But
sometimes when you go in those spaces and you go, and this is where they slept, and this is, it feels just as intimate that you're, you know, intruding.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah. 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 It does. It really does.
Radio Gorgeous.
They do use light and shade beautifully, and water, which, you know, in that part of Europe, it's fantastic. You get a lot of strong sunlight, so you get these wonderful light and shade patterns. And the water, the sound of the twinkling water is just wonderful, you know. Did I say twinkling?
You did.
There you go. It's actually, it is. It's quite a good
and
one.
It's quite evocative.
Yeah.
Well, that was one thing we didn't touch on just now, but I do want to touch on that, is you mentioned before a couple of things, neat tricks with snails.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And lighting.
The issue with lighting is really that in the cities we tend to be out during the day, at work during the day, and come back in the evening. And so lighting plays a much more important part in city gardens than it would in country gardens. Also because they're smaller and you can really play around with light and do some really interesting things. And these days, garden lights mostly run on LEDs, which are very, very low voltage, very low wattage rather, and they do run mostly on low voltage, which is quite safe, and they're also very reliable. So it's worth spending a bit of money on decent lights, but you could light a whole garden for what it would take to run one light bulb 15 years ago. So you could, you know, 60-100 watts, you can light a whole garden,
and that helps create that, some of that drama and those hidden things. It just
the other thing that you get with lighting is you immediately get three different textures, if you like. You get the light and the shade, which are the obvious ones, but you also get this sort of luminescence, because where light passes through foliage, it actually glows in a completely different way. So you get these bright colours of the light coming through the foliage or through the flowers, and then you also get the highlights where the light is striking the face of it, and then you get deep dark shade. So it introduces a lot more drama and depth into a garden than you get in daylight. So and it allows you to play tricks and to emphasise what you want to emphasise. So you light the things that you want to emphasise and let other things recede into the shade, and it can be a lot of fun.
Now tell me about snails.
Snails, well, the first thing is, don't throw them over into your neighbour's garden, because they'll just come back. And also those are your neighbours. Be nice, exactly. Because you might want to get some plants off them and they might want to get some plants off you. But you tend to get snails in the sunnier parts. So if your front garden faces south, you'll get snails in the front, and the back garden faces north, you'll get slugs in the back. That tends to be how it happens. So, but both of them, what they don't like is any contact with metal. So if you put copper tape or even strips of tin foil around, or if you use metal containers, you can get zinc or galvanized containers quite a lot these days. Those are completely slug proof, because they get effectively a mild electrical shock through their slime as they crawl up it. Not pleasant.
No.
And so they just don't go on metal things. So if you have, I see here you've got quite a good metal bench. That would be a really good plant stand. And if you look at Victorian plant stands, they're always metal. So slugs and snails just don't go up them.
Excellent. Right. Any other fab tips for us?
Yes, I think that the other thing is that there are some quite good irrigation systems for gardens now that you can run off a tap. And if they've run off a tap, they don't use a lot of water. You can get battery-fed little valves that open and close. So if you're going on holiday and you can loop them into all the pots, keep all your pots watered. Mostly beds don't really need watering most of the time, and lawns certainly don't. We very rarely irrigate lawns actually these days. And you can also get them to, you can get systems to run off watering butts as well, water butts as well. I've got one in my garden where I've got a submersible pump in. I've got two water butts. One feeds the other. The second one has a submersible pump in, and that waters my vegetables. So the other thing is the first flat that I bought in London years ago had a roof terrace, and it was almost a revelation to me. This was 30 years ago, but it was just the most wonderful space, because it was two, three stories up from the street. It was sunnier, and I had the most fantastic views, and it was more private than a garden at ground level. But actually, I also quite quickly discovered that it was a more challenging environment to grow things in. Well, because if it's sunny at street level, it's really hot and sunny on a roof terrace. If it's windy down at street level, it's really windy when you get up onto a roof terrace. And if it's raining down there, then it's a, you know, so everything is sort of multiplied. And so it's a more challenging environment, but in many ways it's also very rewarding. So the closest analogy is that it's a bit more like a maritime environment without the salt. So plants that do well in maritime environments, or the tops of hillsides, so herby things, you know, lavender, rosemary, things like that do well. Olive trees do well, even in London. You know, we've had olive trees on 7th floor, 10th floor. I can think of one roof garden that I did a couple of years ago, 13th floor, it's got olive trees on it. So even at quite high altitudes, they'll do well because they grow on the top of frosty hillsides. But they can be very rewarding spaces. The wind is the thing to watch out for. But if you try to keep the planting below the level of the balustrade, on the whole, it's going to do better.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much. And the other thing, even as a professional gardener, for people like me, would you just encourage me, just go and do something, because it's a garden, it'll change.
Yeah. It's one of the great things about it is that it will change. It changes all the time, it changes daily, it changes weekly, you know, and you can, I think what we really look for, even if we don't know it often, is seasonality. If you walk through the park and you walk through the park a week later, what you will notice is what's changed. The things that are there always there, you just don't notice them, but it's the change. You notice the bulbs come out, you notice the leaves going red, and that seasonality. So get out there and experience it.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2016. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.